This is the City Surgery. Expert advice for the cost of a phone call. The City Surgery. City Surgery. City Talk 105.9.
And for the next hour here on City Talk 105.9, the doctor is in the house. That's right, Dr. Mike Scott here to answer your questions. So if you've got a question for Dr. Mike, you can pick up the phone, drop us a text, or drop us an email. For the next hour, we're talking about all matters health. So if at the moment you've got a health condition you want to get some advice on, maybe it's a friend or a family member, maybe you're due in hospital soon, or maybe you're going to see a GP and you're looking for some advice before you go there. Maybe you've got advice from a GP, maybe you want to clarify what some of it meant. You can put your questions to Mike over the next hour. 0151 708 1059. That's 0151 708 1059. You can call now. The lines are now open. If you don't want to come on air for whatever reason, that's fine. Just leave your question with the team and they'll pass it across. 61025. Start your message with the word talk or email surgery at citytalk.fm. The easiest way is always the phone, so pick it up and give us a call. 0151 708 1059. And the lines are now open.
City Talk 105.9.
So if at the moment you've got a question about maybe an operation that you've had, maybe it's an operation that you're due to have very soon, you want to know exactly what it might entail, maybe you're due to go and see your GP and you've got a particular condition, you want to make sure you're asking all the right questions, maybe you've asked the right questions, you want to know how to best decipher the answer you were given. Mike is in the studio for the next hour and the phone lines are open if you want to ask him any kind of question. 0151 708 1059. That's 0151 708 1059. And now the team are standing by to take your calls. Put your questions to them first. They'll pass them across if you don't want to come on air, but often it's easier if you do come on air because, of course, Mike might ask you a couple of questions which would be follow-up questions that maybe, you know, get a bit more information out, basically. So 0151 708 1059. The text number is 61025. And Mike, nothing off the agenda.
No, absolutely not, Mick. We must just stress, as I do every week, that I'm not an expert in everything and I don't proclaim to be. I'm really a surgeon. I'm a consultant general surgeon out at Whiston and St. Helens Hospital. I've been a consultant for nearly 20 years. I've worked in many different branches of surgery and a couple of other branches of general medicine over my years in training and as a surgeon. So I can answer a lot of things with authority, but the bits I'm not sure about, I'm not going to just flannel you on. I'll either go away and research it, or I'll try and point you in the right direction.
No flanneling on this show.
I've listened to this show, Mick. You can't fool me.
Dr. Mike Scott with us for the next hour. So your question's more than welcome. And now, if you've got questions that you want to text in, it's 61025. Start your message with the word talk. That's 61025. Start your message with the word talk. And a thank you to everybody who's already emailed their questions in as well. Surgery at citytalk.fm. But plenty of time to get your questions in today. 0151 708 1059. Now, Dr. Mike, I know you enjoy stories, and we always bring the latest from the world of medicine, about life-saving pills.
Yeah,
a cure for what ails you, whatever it might be. When somebody finds a cure and it turns out to be a bit of research, which might mean in the future there's a possibility that no one will ever die of heart attacks again or something like that. We always like to bring the story up because you always shoot them down. So I've sort of started finding these stories and thinking I'll save these for Dr. Mike. So there was one which I picked out, I think it was from yesterday, a pill that costs only £1.40 a day could save the lives of thousands of heart failure patients every year. This is the drug ivabradine, which slows the heart rate and improves its pumping ability. Can cut deaths by up to 39%. This isn't me saying this, Dr. Mike. These are trials, and they've done trials through the Royal Brompton Hospital. And it says, at a conservative estimate, it could save between 5,000 and 10,000 lives a year, all for the sake of £1.40 a day.
Yep, and I know you've put this up there for me to shoot down. I'm going to disappoint you. I'm not going to shoot this one down. But I am going to just clarify a few things. I saw this article in the Daily Mail. It was either yesterday or the day before. It had a picture of a chap clutching his chest, having a heart attack. And then they put this article about this pill. Now, let me just stress this. This pill is not a heart attack pill, okay? This is where people often get confused. Heart failure is one condition, and a heart attack, whatever you want to call it, a myocardial infarction, a coronary thrombosis, a heart attack is something different, And I know we've had this discussion before. This pill is designed to treat people with heart failure. Now, if you have heart failure, and that can have been caused by a heart attack, when you had a heart attack, that leaves some scarring in the heart. It might affect the way the heart beats, and that can give you heart failure. But what heart failure means, it means that this bag of muscles that works away automatically day and night, 24/7, pumping blood round our body and round our lungs, this phenomenal piece of engineering starts to fail. And it starts to fail because it can't push the blood round as well as it could. And there are lots and lots of reasons why you can get heart failure. And heart failure kills you basically because you don't get to the blood, that your blood to the places where it's needed most. And so you might not get enough oxygen from your lungs. You might not get enough blood into your lungs. You might not get enough blood into various organs in your body. And classically, people get breathless, their ankles swell up, they can get tummy pains. There are all sorts of things that heart failure can have show itself in different ways. Now, this pill, which is going to be an amazing pill, is a combination pill. But what it essentially does is it slows your heart down and makes it beat more efficiently. So it's a bit like a beta blocker. It doesn't work in the same way as a beta blocker, but it's a bit like a beta blocker in that it slows your heart and makes this pumping of the heart even better. And so because it's doing that, it's saying that the people who have heart failure or who are likely to have heart failure affecting other parts of their body, they're going to benefit. And that's why they're speculating that so many people's lives are going to be made better and saved. And so, no, I'm not going to shoot it down because I actually think this is really, really exciting. And it's still not available. It's still on trials, but the trials are British trials. And one of the things that as a doctor, when you read medical papers, you always tend to trust British trials because there are such strict rules about clinical trials in the UK. You can't make claims that you can't back up. And I really, really think that this has come from a very auspicious unit at the Royal Brompton Hospital. And I think that this is going to be really worth keeping an eye on.
On the point about heart failure, so when your heart fails, do you then have a heart attack, or is it the problems that you have as a result of a heart attack?
Yeah, it's the problems. When you have a heart attack, a proper heart attack, that can damage the wall, or that does damage the wall of your heart such that it doesn't beat properly. And so that is one of the causes of heart failure. It isn't the only cause of heart failure. And heart failure itself sometimes can bring about a poor blood supply to your heart. And so heart failure itself can sometimes stimulate a heart attack, but they're not the same thing.
Let's get to some questions, Dr. Mike. Loads of stuff coming through, and the phone lines are open if you want to ring in with your questions. 0151 708 1059. That's 0151 708 1059. The lines are open, and the team are standing by to take your calls, and we'll come to some questions in a few moments' time. Let's get to the emails. The subject of the email is hard small lumps, so we'll go with this one. I have a reoccurring one in my groin under my skin. It moves and is about pea size. This is from Paul. He says, I've had a cyst or such lanced and stuffed with some stuff about 6 years ago under my armpit, and those reoccur occasionally, but I've not had to have one removed again since then. Currently, he says, I have two hard bumps on the back of my neck directly under my skull on either side of my spine. These usually don't bother me except for when I have a headache, but they have grown recently, are very tender to the touch. The right side is very painful, but it seems to be smaller now. No other symptoms. Okay. Paul in Egbeth.
All right, Paul in Egbeth. I think from that you've got lumps in your groin, lumps in your armpit, lumps in your neck. Now, those areas are classically get two problems that give you lumps. One of the problems is that you can have lymph glands. And depending on your body build, if you're very skinny, it's very easy to feel lymph glands. And we have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of lymph glands in our body. And their job is to just clean the blood effectively. And they filter out infection and other problems from the blood. So that if occasionally they swell up and become sore because either you've got a virus or they're mopping up some infection. Now, that's a common cause for lumps, little hard lumps that come and go, groin, armpit and neck. But you say in your email that you've had them lanced in your groin. Now, if they're all exactly the same thing, there is a condition, and I'm sorry to use big words here because it's, you know how as doctors are, we often hide things in Greek or Latin, called hidradenitis suppurativa. And what that is...
That was a good one, that one.
I know. We haven't had that one, have we? And what that is, it basically just means infected sweat glands. And of course, we have a preponderance of sweat glands in our groins, our armpits, and around the collar of our neck. And what hidradenitis suppurativa is a condition whereby the sweat glands get infected, and nobody quite knows why certain people get it. But if you're going to get it, it's usually women rather than men, but men can get it, and it's usually in the cracks and creases. It's more common in diabetics. It's more common in people who are overweight. It's more common in people who work in a hot environment and get very sweaty. There isn't an out-and-out cure for hidradenitis suppurativa. You can put fluid in your bath to sterilise the skin. It's not about hygiene. It's just something that happens. Some people need antibiotics. Very occasionally, people need surgery to help them with this condition. It's not serious. And rather bizarrely, you tend to grow out of it, which would tend to suggest there's some kind of hormonal element to it as well. But it's never anything to be worried about.
Okay, Paul, thank you for your question on the email. Lots of people coming through, leaving their questions with the team. That's absolutely fine. Maybe you might think it's an embarrassing thing, or don't worry about that. If there's anything which you think is embarrassing, it won't be anything we've not already heard before, Mike. It's fair
absolutely
to say.
Not. People should see this show as embarrassing bodies for the radio, which it doesn't quite work the same way, but they shouldn't be embarrassed with anything they want to phone in about.
0151 708 1059 is the number to call. That's 0151 708 1059. Right, let's crack on with a couple more questions. Now, Terry's called. He doesn't want to come on air, but he's been diagnosed with passing blood. He's had 5 internal exams with a camera, and his doctor said he had polyps and they have to be removed. There may be a possibility that part of his colon needs to be removed and then reattached. If that's the case, what's the scenario for recovery?
Wow. Okay, by passing blood, I'm assuming he means passing blood in his poop from his bottom.
Ah, no, these are like the adverts.
Yeah. Well, while you've brought that up, Mick, I know that our listeners get very almost bored with those public information adverts about blood in your poo, change of bowel habit. Let me tell you this, Mick. In the last, how long have they been running now? A couple of months, I've seen a massive increase in the number of patients who come to clinic having heard those adverts. And in a significant number of them, we are finding disease, okay? And I can't stress enough that listen to the adverts, and if those adverts are talking about you, you get to your doctor, and don't be fobbed off by your doctor. Just this morning in my clinic, I saw a lady with bowel cancer who had been to see a GP, and the GP had told her not to be silly because it was piles. Didn't examine her, just told her it was piles. Fortunately, this lady said, no, I've listened to the advert on the television. I want investigation. And they found a very, very early cancer that we will cure. And I can't stress it enough how important it is.
There was a gentleman actually on the breakfast show, if people are listening earlier on today, his name was Alan, and he lived out in Walton, and he'd gone through 3 lots of either cancer or tumours, that he'd always put it down to IBS or irritable bowel syndrome. And he said that the thing that saved him was that his wife was nagging and saying, yeah, you know what? So actually, if it's not you, if you're hearing the adverts and you're thinking, well, maybe it's, it sounds like somebody within your family that needs to get that advice.
And you know what patients will often say? I'm sorry if I'm wasting your time. Gee, no, don't ever think that way. That's what I'm paid for. I'm not paid to find cancer in everybody and to treat cancer in everybody. I'm paid to show people what they haven't got as well as what they have got. Anyway.
So let's go back to Terry,
who had polyps
to be removed.
Polyps, right. Terry, when you have polyps in your colon, in your large intestine, essentially, polyps fall into two groups. There's one group that is essentially nothing more than a birthmark. And once you've had, you know, a camera test, had a little piece of the polyp taken off or the whole polyp taken off, it's, if it's one of these birthmark type of polyps, you need have no further treatment. However, more commonly, we see polyps that are actually little tumours. Most of them, the vast, vast majority of them, are benign, non-cancerous tumours. And when we take those off, we look at them under the microscope, and the pathologist gives us an opinion as to how abnormal they are. And there is a spectrum from, you know, so innocuous, they virtually need nothing doing to them, to the other end of the scale, whereby they are cancer or nearly cancer. Now, if you have lots and lots of polyps, there is a condition called polyposis coli, meaning, again, the big word thing, that you have lots of polyps in your colon. And they often it often runs in families, in which case it's called familial polyposis coli. And your risks of getting bowel cancer go up dramatically if you've got that condition. So if you have a lot of polyps, or if the polyps look a bit abnormal under the microscope, even if they're not cancers, if they look like they could turn into cancers, one of the treatment options is to have your colon removed and then have the small intestine sewn essentially onto your bottom, onto your lower rectum. It's a big operation, and I'm not going to say for a minute that it's an easy operation, either for the surgeon nor for the patient. And if you need it, it's being done to stop you getting bowel cancer and therefore to save your life. It's a big operation, and you should write off at least 3 months of your life, because that's how long it'll take to get over this kind of surgery.
Okay, thank you, caller. If you want to come through on the phones, it's 0151 708 1059. That's 0151 708 1059. People busy on the email as well today. Surgery@citytalk.fm. We've got a question about a hysterectomy, actually, that we'll come to next on City Talk.
This is the City Surgery. The City Surgery. Expert advice for the cost of a phone call. City Talk 105.9.
And it's 28 minutes past 12. A very good afternoon. My name's Mick Coyle. This is City Talk 105.9. The health surgery today with our resident doc, Dr. Mike Scott, who's here to answer your questions. Thank you for everybody who's contacting the show today with your questions. We will get through as many as we can between now and 1 o'clock. If you want to text in your questions, it's 61025. Start your message with the word talk, or give us a call, 0151 708 1059. That's 0151 708 1059. Now, plenty of stuff moving, Dr. Mike, on the email today. Can you ask Dr. Mike a question for me? Sure. My wife has been offered a keyhole hysterectomy. She's had terrible period pains and bleeding for years, so we've been offered this new procedure. We have agreed to this operation as the recovery time is good. Just wondered, has Dr. Mike heard of this keyhole surgery, and is it a good option?
Okay, it's not desperately new, actually. It's called a laparoscopic hysterectomy, and it basically means that rather than having the usual bikini line cut that we associate with a hysterectomy, it's done in a slightly different way, and it's all the blood supply and the tubes that connect to the uterus are divided using a keyhole camera technique, and then subsequently the uterus is taken out via the vagina. It's a great operation. It's not for everybody having hysterectomies. Before people out there think, oh, hang on, I wasn't offered that. There are only certain uteruses, wombs, that lend themselves to this type of surgery. Yes, it does. You, like all what's called minimal access surgery, you will get over it a little bit quicker. There will always be a balance in amongst surgeons of those that feel that keyhole surgery is better or worse than conventional surgery. For example, in my field, in the gallbladder world, everybody nowadays, virtually, who has their gallbladder out, has their operation done or attempted to be done the keyhole way, because it's probably better than having a big cut. But there are still surgeons around who do the operation very well through a cut. Similarly so, hiatus hernia surgery. Hiatus hernia surgery is now almost universally done the keyhole way, which is much better than the massive great cut that you used to get to have hiatus hernia surgery. So minimal access surgery is good surgery in that it helps you to get over your operation a little bit quicker. And yes, it is a good operation. I always say that the most important thing is not actually the operation, it's the person doing it. And so all that you need to do is check that your surgeon that's offered your wife this operation has done this plenty of times. You don't want to be his first case or her first case. You want to be sure that this doctor can say to you, do you know what? I've done this many of them. These were the results. This was how quickly the patients went home. These were the potential complications, and these were the complications that we had. But yes, I'm very confident that I can offer you this operation safely. And to me, that's the way that you should be going. But yes, it's a good operation. But let me stress again, I know I sound like I'm repeating myself, it is not for everyone. And there are a lot of conditions that ladies get in their wombs that mean it cannot be done the keyhole way. But for heavy periods, it strikes me that it would be an ideal operation for that particular condition. And as long as your surgeon's up for it, which it sounds as if they are, then go for it.
Okay, thank you for your question. 61025 is the text number. Start your message with the word talk. Let's do this question from Carl. Dr. Mike, he's a 19-year-old male, healthy, average weight, etc. About half an hour, 30 minutes after eating, I feel very tired for a short while to the point I actually want to go to sleep. I have reduced meal sizes and it still happens. Any advice, please?
Yeah, this is well known, well described. You only have to look, and I know I sound like I'm talking away from the point now, but you only have to look at animals. If you feed your cat or your dog, what do? You feed them, they go out to the loo, they come back, they curl up in their basket, they go to sleep. It's a normal physiological response. But as human beings, we tend to override that physiological response. In fact, both of them, most people resist going to the loo unless they feel they absolutely have to. And most people don't have the luxury of being able to curl up in their basket, in their bed and go to sleep. But some people, it depends on how busy your life is, I think. Some people, particularly if, you see it particularly amongst students, in that maybe their life isn't that full, maybe they've got a quiet time and they sort of go with the physiological response, but you can usually physically override it by going and doing something and making yourself active. It's all down to the way that your sugar is moved around your body. Well, that's the theory anyway. So what you could do is you could keep a food diary, and you may find that certain foods do it to you more so than others. So particularly sweet food, food with a lot of salt in it, that can sometimes do it. But just keep a food diary. But more than anything, what I would suggest is that after you've had something to eat, go and find something to do. And almost certainly what will happen is you will teach your body to not listen to this physiological response and you'll be able to override it. It's never anything pathological.
Okay, thank you for your text. That was Carl on 61025. Start your message with the word talk. If you want to come through on the phones today, 0151 708 1059. That's 0151 708 1059. A short one on the text. What does the thickening of the wall of the stomach indicate?
Right. Now, that's one of those questions, isn't it, that you wonder what they're talking about. What I mean by the stomach is the bag that is the first place your food hits when after it's gone down your gullet. It's actually a big muscular bag that stores the food and starts digestion. The only problem is that some people, when they talk about their stomach, just mean their abdomen. And so,
your belly.
Yeah, the bit between your chest and your groin, And when people say, I've got stomach ache, they actually mean it's somewhere in that area. If we're talking specifically about the wall of the stomach, the bag, the anatomical structure of the stomach, if the wall is thickened, it can mean a number of things, depending on your age, depending on your other symptoms. At its most serious, it can mean that there is a special type of tumour in the wall of your stomach. It's relatively rare. It's called linitis plastica, and it's not good news. Having said that, that's the rarity. Sometimes if people's outlet of their stomach is a bit tight, then the stomach has to work harder and the wall gets a bit thicker because it's just a muscle. In some people, the wall is just a bit thicker. In some people who've had a scan, depending on the state that their stomach was in their digestive state their stomach was in, at that moment that the scan was taken, the wall of the stomach can look thick when it isn't. It just happens to be in a contraction. So if this is something that's been picked up on an X-ray, really it doesn't tell you anything. The next step is, if an X-ray or a scan has said you've got the thickened wall of your stomach, the next step is you have to have a gastroscopy, which is the camera test to look at the lining under direct vision, and probably a biopsy. So it's very difficult to answer this question because there isn't enough information. Maybe they can email or text us back and give us a little bit more so that we know what I'm dealing with.
Sure. 61025. Start your message with the word talk. You can also email your questions across surgery@citytalk.fm. If you want to ring up, that's absolutely great. 0151 708 1059. 0151 708 1059. You've got until 1 o'clock to put your questions across to Dr. Mike. Can I ask you about this child who was in the news because they've gone orange? They've turned orange.
Yeah.
A little boy who's been nicknamed the Tango Kid. I mean, there's no imagination shown there at all, is there? Because carrots turn him orange. His name is Leo Barnett. He's 3 years of age. Believed to be the only person in the UK with hyperbeta-carotenemia. Carotenemia?
Yeah.
Which sounds like somebody's made it up, but it's they cause carotene to build up, and it basically his skin goes bright orange.
Yeah. He's obviously missing an enzyme, and it's the enzyme that digests carotene. And it's found in things like carrots and oranges and things like that. And if you don't have the enzyme that digests it, then the beta-carotene kind of floats around in your body, and the beta-carotene is an orange colour. So you develop orange tango skin. It's sad, but essentially all that he needs to do is his parents have to modify his diet for him. I don't think it has any other implications, to be honest with you. I don't know a lot about it. Obviously, if he's the only case in the country, it's not something I've seen a lot of. And I doubt that anybody's seen very much of it, to be honest with you.
Mummy's very supportive of this one. She says he'd had pneumonia. We were very close to losing him. When he was ill, his body started to shut down. If we'd left him another day, he would have been dead. She goes on to say, we used to call him the Tango Kid and Oompa Loompa because of his colour. He looks like someone from The Only Way Is Essex when they have overdone it on the fake tan. Bless him.
Yeah, it's all to do with carotene and vitamin A, and it's an enzyme in the liver that doesn't work very well. And he just needs to modify his diet, I suspect.
Right, let's get some people on the phones. If you want to call up and put your questions to Dr. Mike between now and 1 o'clock, now is a good time to call. 0151 708 1059. Don't miss the chance. 0151 708 1059. The text number 61025. Start your message with the word talk or email your questions to surgery@citytalk.fm. We'll get through as many questions as we can between now and 1 o'clock. The phone lines are open. Call now 708 1059.
This is the City Surgery, City Talk 105.9.
And it's nearly 1:45. It's City Talk 105.9 across Liverpool, the North West and North Wales. The health surgery today, we've got Dr. Mike Scott here in the studio to help you out. So if you've got a question, 0151 708 1059. Let's go to the phones, Dr. Mike, because we've got Paul on the line with a question about his shoulder. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Doc.
What can I do for you?
Well, what it is, the back of my shoulder, and it goes down my right-hand side of my arm. I've had it a couple of times in my arm, on my right-hand side, and I've had it once on my left side. Well, I haven't had no shortness of breath or no pains in my chest. So I'm just wondering, is it something sort of, I've got, is it sat nervous? It always seems to happen when I wake up in the morning when I get out of bed.
Okay, do you get any tingling in your fingers?
No.
Okay, and can I ask you how old you are?
50.
Okay, do you get any arthritis? Have you got arthritis anywhere in your body?
I don't think so, no. I'm quite limp.
Okay. Limbo. Okay, well, generally speaking, if you get pain that goes from your shoulders down your arms, both sides, it's a fairly safe bet that's nothing to do with your heart. And I understand why you're worrying about that, because generally speaking, people who have heart pain, it can go down their left arm. But it's, it's usually the left arm. If you're getting it both sides, and it's worse in the morning, what that suggests to me is that you've got a little bit of early arthritis of your neck. Okay. Now, it's obviously not that bad because you're not getting the tingling in your fingers, but it sounds to me as if you've probably getting a little bit of trapped nerves in your neck whilst before you get up and get going. And it's almost certainly secondary to something called osteoarthritis, which is essentially the type of arthritis that we get when we've been lying still for a while. And then once we get going, it's like the joints warm up a bit and whatever they're impinging on, the nerves they're impinging on, it kind of goes away. What I would suggest you do is...
Sorry for interrupting. It doesn't happen all the time. It's every now and again. And when it does happen, it's like the pain's really... It's like someone stabbed me in the back. It lasts for about 5 minutes before...
Right. And how far down your back?
It's just behind the back of my shoulder blades, but it goes down, you know... the back of my shoulder blade.
Yeah.
My shoulder.
Yeah.
And then it goes down my arm.
Right, okay. Well, that would fit completely with just a trapping nerve at the lower part of your neck, upper part of your chest, what they call, you know, round about the lower cervical, upper thoracic vertebrae. And what I would do is, if it was me getting that, I would go just start with just getting a plain X-ray of my upper back, my what they call the cervical vertebrae and the thoracic vertebrae, and just look to see if there are any arthritic changes in there. I suspect there will be. If the plain X-ray shows a bit of arthritis, you then need to know what it's catching on. And if that's the case, you might need an MRI scan. It really doesn't sound like anything serious. You've not got any problems with swallowing or anything like that?
No problems swallowing.
No. Okay. Then Paul, I wouldn't be worrying about this unduly. I think it's probably just wear and tear because you've got 50 candles on your birthday cake. And that's that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much, Doc.
My pleasure.
Cheers, Paul. That's Paul in West Derby, from West Derby up to Kirby. Stan's on the line. Hi, Stan.
Yeah, hi.
You're through to Dr. Mike.
Hello, Stan.
Hello.
What can I do for you?
I just said I've got this tetanus shot, and it seems to go worse when I'm on the bus, you know, when I haven't had a drink for a while, when I leave for a while, I get the cough, or I ended up, you know, getting the sweets or something, you know.
Yeah, and do you cough anything up?
I have a bit of phlegm here now, but I've had that for years.
Okay, and do you smoke, or did you used to?
I don't smoke, no.
Never smoked?
Oh, I have smoked, many years ago.
Okay. Well, what that sounds like is a bit of a chronic bronchitis, a bit of COPD. Is it worse in some weathers than others?
No.
Okay. And when you've coughed, does it feel better? Do you feel like you're getting a full breath?
Yeah, it's all right, yeah.
Yeah, what it probably is, it's probably that your pipes in your lungs are making a little bit too much mucus, and because years and years ago you were a smoker, they can't clear it out on their own, so the only way of clearing it out is with a good cough. And to be honest, that doesn't matter. And as long as the stuff you're coughing up hasn't got any blood in it, then don't go worrying. If it goes a bit green, then it's probably worth popping along to your GP so that your GP can have a listen to your chest and make sure there's no infection in there.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't go worried about it unduly.
I thought you might suggest something too easy, you know, some tablets or something.
No. I think that you, probably just coughing is the answer to the problem, because your body makes you cough for a reason. All right.
All right, Stan, thank you for your question. Appreciate it. Stan and Kirby on 0151 708 1059. Dr. Mike Scott here in the studio to take your questions. The phone lines are open. We're going to speak to Al in Tewbrook. Hi, Al. Thank you for your call. You're through to Dr. Mike. What's your question about?
Hi. Yeah, what it is, your question's about a medication called Mitotane, chemotherapy medication. When you come off it, does it your immune system improve?
What have you been taking it for?
Well, it's not me, it's my wife. She had an adrenalectomy in 2009.
Right.
But subsequently, last April, she had a PA in her lung.
Right.
She had pneumonia in August just gone, and she's in hospital at the moment again with pneumonia.
Right, but she's not on chemo anymore.
The medication, since she's been in, they said they're going to probably take it off her. Take it off that mitotane from now on.
Right, okay. Then the way they're thinking is that this is, it is affecting her immune system. That's probably what they're thinking. And they may be thinking that as a consequence of her being on the medication, it's affecting the way she's able to respond to infections. And so probably the way that they're looking at it is by taking her off the medication, her immune system will be a little more robust and be able to deal with the sort of infections that you and I would just shrug off. What I would tend to do in these kind of, when you've got these kind of questions, patients and patients' relatives often don't like to go and question the doctor that's done it. But do you know what? I try to encourage my patients to do that, to go and come and talk to me and say, why have we done this? Why have you done that? What's your thinking? And that's what I would do, because the worst thing in the world is for patients and patients' loved ones to go home thinking, we don't know why they've done all this. What's the problem? What's their thinking? So what I would do if I was you is make an appointment to see your wife's doctor that's looking after her at the moment, even if it's, you know, just a member of the team, doesn't have to be the consultant, just a member of the team, and go and say, you know, not in a confrontational way, but just along the lines of, you know, I understand we're stopping this. What's your thinking on that? Is it because the immune system, you think the immune system's a bit compromised? And they'll just tell you it, you know, because that's their job. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But I would have thought that that's probably why they've done it.
Right, that's great. All right, thanks for your help.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Cheers.
Bye. Cheers, Al. Thanks for your call. Alan Chibrook on 0151 708 1059. But a question before about hysterectomy. You were asking about saying to the surgeon, you know, have you done, you know, the operation before? The surgeon says the correspondent he's emailed back in has done this keyhole hysterectomy many times before. But he told me and my wife that if it doesn't work, then he will have to do a normal hysterectomy. My wife has had 13 gyno operations in the last 12 years, including three microwave abbreviations, and she's only 45. Also had four marina coils fitted. We were worried about the operation. I've heard that women getting this done are really ill for months afterwards. Sorry to bother you again. I know you're very busy. It's not bothering us at all.
Not in the slightest. That's what we're here for. Well, firstly, yeah, great. The surgeon knows what he's doing. Right. But every time we do a keyhole operation, what we always say to the patient having the keyhole operation, that occasionally we can't do it the keyhole because of the way you're built inside or because of the extent of the disease. And if that should happen, we don't wake the patient up and go, no, we can't do it. You just go on and do it the old-fashioned way. And it's called conversion, okay? So conversion to the open operation. And all that you need to do, if you want to sort of clarify the figures, is to say to the consultant, what's your conversion rate? And doesn't matter what the operation is, be it hiatus hernias, gallbladders, incisional hernias, whatever it is, the surgeon will have a conversion rate. And the fact that your wife's had so many procedures may mean that she has a few more adhesions around her womb, and that might be a reason why he or she, your gynecologist, isn't able to do it the keyhole way. But, you know, that's what they're there for as well. Have a chat with them. Just talk to them. All that I would say is that somebody who's well experienced in doing the operation will know their limitations. And sometimes when you put the camera in somebody's tummy, you know almost straight away that you can't do it the keyhole way. Sometimes you have to spend a bit of time trying to do some dissection, seeing what it looks like. But experienced surgeons will reach a point where they go, there is no point in going on any longer. This operation needs to be turned into an open operation. But you're wrong about the lengthy recovery from a hysterectomy. Sometimes people are over-cosseted after their abdominal surgery. And to be honest with you, your wife should be over a hysterectomy within 6 to 8 weeks. You know, she may have to phase her life back to normal over a period of 3 months, but most people are over it by certainly 8 weeks.
Been a busy old show today, Dr. Mike.
Yeah, it's been a great show.
Sunday night from 9 o'clock.
Yeah. I'm still waiting on a couple of people phoning in. I'm hoping, phoning me back, but I'm hoping to have a matron and a senior nurse from a ward coming to talk about the nursing aspects of working in hospitals. So, and the matrons don't all look like Hattie Jakes now, you know.
I look forward to it, Dr. Mike. 9 o'clock Sunday night here on City Talk 105.9. And Dr. Mike is back in the studio next Thursday, 12 until 1. So if you've got questions you want to email over the course of the week, drop them across surgery@citytalk.fm.
This is the City Surgery. Expert advice for the cost of a phone call. The City Surgery. City Surgery. City Talk 105.9.